Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. This show is brought to you by ChrisCresser.com, and I'm your host, Steve Wright. My website is scdlifestyle.com. But with me is integrative medical practitioner and healthy skeptic, Chris Cresser. So Chris, how's your day going?
It's good. I'm taking it a little easy today. We had the big pre-launch of my book this morning. Everyone will be hearing this a week after that. And of course, you know, three things went wrong at the last minute. So we were up late last night trying to figure it out, and it all went off smoothly this morning. But I'm a little tired from that, but feeling good otherwise. Really excited to be that my book is out there now, ready for pre-order, and just the fun is really beginning.
Yeah, I hear those, you know, bringing those new products to the market and releasing those new things always goes, you know, just smooth as can be, smooth sailing. Right.
Exactly. Got it.
Well, congratulations. This is a big first step, and it's like entering into the foothills, right? You're about to climb the mountains.
Yeah. We'll be talking about it more in the future, but today we're excited to have another great guest to talk to, Joe Robinson, who wrote the book called Eating on the Wild Side, really fascinating. And we're going to talk to her in a few minutes here.
Okay, well, before we bring Joe on, I want to tell everyone about Beyond Paleo. So if you're new to the Revolution Health Radio Show, say you're new to the paleo diet, or you're just interested in optimizing your health, you're going to want to check out what over 30,000 other people have signed up for. What it is, it's Chris's free 13-part email series called Beyond Paleo. And in each of these emails, he's going to send you his best tips and tricks for burning fat, boosting energy, and preventing and reversing disease without drugs. So if this is something of interest, which, like I said, over 30,000 other people have already signed up for, including myself, head over to chriscresser.com, look for the big red box, and put your name and email in that box, and Chris will send you the first free email later today. Okay, Chris, is Joe ready?
I think we're going to patch her in. Let's do it. So, Joe, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got interested in this subject. I've been aware of your website, Eat Wild, for some time, so I'm just curious to hear more about where you're coming from.
I have been interested in food and nutrition since high school. I wrote my first cookbook in high school.
Wow.
And when I was in college, I was doping all of my strung-out friends with B vitamins, recuperative vitamin C, and that's because I had a grandmother who lived with us who was a food activist. She was actually protesting white bread and Coca-Cola in 1910.
That's amazing.
And yeah, so I got imprinted with this at an early age. Mm-hmm. And have been interested in natural foods, whole foods, and health.
Mm-hmm. So your book, for listeners, I mentioned it earlier on, but it is called Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. And I've read a couple of articles about it, and I actually just heard you today on Fresh Air as I was driving home for this interview. So you mentioned you reviewed over 6,000 peer-reviewed studies and writing this book, and it's been 10 years in the making. That is quite a project.
It was a real tour de force for me. I loved doing it. I just kept finding more and more nuggets of information that were in these academic journals, good information, but nobody was bringing it to the public. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every day I'd search through journals and find more and more that I thought consumers should be using right now.
Yeah, kind of like a treasure hunt, huh?
It was very much like a treasure hunt. It still is very much like that for me.
I can definitely relate to that. So, you know, a lot of my listeners, of course, are familiar with we talk about ancestral health and the switch from a hunter-gatherer type of lifestyle to agriculture. And of course, that switch brought a lot of benefits, but it was not without costs. And your book really focuses on one of perhaps the most significant costs from a health perspective, which was how the transition from wild plants to cultivated plants affects nutrient density and nutrient variety. So, you know, tell us a little bit more about that transition and what happened and why it happened.
What's so interesting about this whole field about the difference between wild plants in terms of their polyphenols or phytonutrients and our modern ones, it's been only within the last 15 or 20 years that we've had the technology to understand and measure these differences, and in the fields of medical research to know what these phytonutrients are doing for us. And so I was just alarmed, really, by the differences in phytonutrients, which are these plant compounds, which are beneficial to the plant, first and foremost, but also to ourselves, and what we see in the store. In some cases, there would be a hundredfold difference. So a wild plant might have 100 times more of these phytonutrients than what we're eating today. This is, you know, astounding difference.
Yeah, it's almost unbelievable.
For health. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this decision to begin cultivating wild plants, it was like, I think, many decisions that happened along the course of human evolution. It started out seeming like a good idea, but then had some unforeseen consequences. So why did our ancestors start doing that in the first place?
Well, I think we don't stop and think about this. The fact that there's 7 million species of animals on the planet, and we're the only ones of all of them who have walked away from our wild diet and created a new menu.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that we did it is because of our large brains. We had the ability to foresee the future and plan for it, and enormous capabilities and great powers of observation. And 10, 12,000 years ago, we realized that there were some plants that tasted a lot better to us than others, and that were much more productive, easier to harvest and gather. And so basically, we just looked at each other and said, we can do better than this. And from that point on, this 400 generations, we have continued to select and breed plants ever tastier, ever larger, and unwittingly lower in key nutrients.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that they taste better, is that a lot of the most nutrient-dense foods and the foods that have these phytonutrients and phytochemicals that we're only now starting to understand the benefits of often have bitter and astringent types of flavors, don't they?
They do, and it turns out to be the most potent ones.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I studied Chinese medicine and herbology, and of course in herbology that's the same is the case. Some of the most potent, powerful botanicals in the pharmacopoeia are the ones that you can hardly choke down because they're so bitter.
Right.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So it's another kind of side effect of this transition to an agricultural diet, not just a change in the actual foods that we're eating, but a change in the quality of the same foods, from corn,
right,
which was hardly even recognizable as corn, as you pointed out. Is it teosinte? Is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that transition. I thought that's pretty fascinating.
Sure. The wild ancestor of our modern corn is teosinte, a bushy plant that has 5 to 12 kernels per spike, and they didn't even have cobs with, silk and all of these things wrapped around them. It was just these spikes of grain that were in hard cases, as hard as an acorn. They were, the inside part, the kernel, was about 2% sugar and 30% protein.
Mm.
And over the millennia, we have created a plant that is so different, it's almost impossible to relate to. Our modern white corn, super sweet corn, is 4% protein and between 30 and 45% sugar.
Wow.
And the other thing that we've done is that we've bred out all those colors, a lot of the ancestral corn was blue or black, red, orange, dark yellow. And those colors are indicative of the anthocyanin content. Anthocyanins are being investigated for their ability to fight cancer, obesity, diabetes, chronic inflammation, early onset Alzheimer's, incredibly important nutrients. And we just took corn and blanched it, basically. So mm-hmm. now what we have is either white or pale yellow corn. So it's we've lost those anthocyanins, we've lost the protein, and we've have this huge infusion of sugar.
How many of these varieties are, I'm not sure if you came across this in the research, but that, for example, I was listening to a program about rice and all the different varieties of rice that there used to be and how they were, you know, farmers knew which varieties of rice to grow in certain situations. Some were more resilient to drought, some were more resilient to, you know, in flooding situations. And the program was talking about how many of these varieties have been lost forever. How many of these wild plants do we still have access to, the seeds and you know, are they, how much of it has been lost and how much of it can we recover?
Most of those wild plants, ancestral plants, still exist. They exist in small pockets in their area of origin. So wild tomatoes came from the Andes, and if you mm-hmm. were to go up in the flanks of the Andes, you would still find the very same wild tomatoes. They were harvested by hunter-gatherers, mm-hmm. and hundreds of more varieties. You just many, many different nuances of color and flavor and nutrient content. And as you say, we have just winnowed them down to very few. In some cases, we only have one variety in the supermarket, like our banana.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this one variety that everybody eats, and we think this is what the banana is.
Right.
And it's, you know, there's 400 different varieties that are being eaten around the world. And in this country, we just have this pale white one that is extremely low in carotenoids.
Mm-hmm. So what are some other examples? You mentioned already corn, of course, which is a really dramatic transition. All right, what others come to mind in terms of the bananas, as you just mentioned, too? But are there any others that have, that come to your mind in terms of a really dramatic difference from the wild varieties to the current varieties? And then on the other side of that coin, are there some examples of foods that haven't changed that much that someone would encounter, you know, at the grocery store, at the farmer's market?
Most of our fruits and vegetables have changed dramatically. Apples is a good example. Most of the wild apples in the world are as small as cherries, and they have these long stems that are two or three times longer than the fruit. So they look like cherries. And they, you know, were, you know, since they were so small, it was mostly seed and very bitter.
Mm-hmm.
We would not eat those apples today, but the hunter-gatherers all around the world did. And some of them, there's this one variety that still grows in Nepal. It has 400 times more antioxidants than some of the ones in our supermarket. Yeah, it's astonishing, really.
Mm-hmm. And we'll come back to that. I know in your book you mentioned some strategies to maximize nutrient density using stuff that is available, you know,
right,
vegetables and fruits that are. We'll come back to that towards the end. I want to ask you a little bit about some other aspects of modern food processing and, you know, industrialized food production that negatively affect nutrient quality. So, you know, we're talking about cultivation here, but you mentioned some other aspects of the industrialized food system that decrease nutrient quality,
yeah,
like when a food is picked and when it's actually eaten, for example, or how it's stored or processed.
Yes, we didn't know until, these studies are so new, they're 10 years old, 15 years old, that freshness is not just about flavor, but it's about antioxidant activity.
Mm-hmm.
There's plants, as you know, once they're picked, they're not really dead. They continue to respire, and they burn up their antioxidants and their stored sugars by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
And some plants burn it up much more rapidly than others, and it turns out that the ones that are most highly recommended for health, and this is asparagus and broccoli and kale and spinach, mushrooms, arugula, lettuce, they respire so rapidly that within 2 or 3 days of harvest, they might have half or even less of the antioxidants. They're more bitter and they don't have their natural sugars. So they don't taste as good, and they're much less better for us. And we just assumed, well, if they could arrive in the grocery store and still look fresh. I mean, the whole thing is now, how can we grow varieties that will look fresh, even though they've been shipped for a week and in a warehouse for up to 6 months, you know, from a week to 6 months, and still look fresh? And they figured that out. But what they haven't done is they haven't held on to the sugars, the flavor, and especially the antioxidants.
The nutrients, right? Yeah, we've talked a lot on this show about the importance of eating locally from this perspective. And it's, you know, you can easily imagine a situation where you go to the grocery store, you pick out some broccoli. That broccoli has been picked, you know, what's the average amount of time? Is there an average, or does it vary a lot? You know, if you see some broccoli on a shelf, how long has it been there?
This one study that looked at the difference in and you know, the total nutrient content of broccoli when it's first picked, and when it's in the supermarket, an average of about 7 weeks later, it found that after that 7 weeks, they fed it to rats and all these different models of cancer and cardiovascular disease, and found out that at the end of that 7 weeks, which is when we buy it from a supermarket, it had lost its ability to fight cancer and reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke. It's scary.
It is, yeah, and it's very few people know about that, and you know, it's there's kind of a perception now that if you get organic broccoli, it must be, you know, from the supermarket, it's going to be more nutrient dense. But the reality is a lot. When it's picked and how quickly it's consumed is far, far more important than whether it's organic or not organic, isn't it? From a nutrient perspective.
Vegetables. Yeah, And when you think that we lost, you know, it's only in probably 1900 that we went away from local production and local consumption. This is a new phenomenon.
Right.
And I think that our chronic health problems is a reflection of that.
So really the ideal scenario would be, of course, growing broccoli in your own backyard and eating and harvesting and eating it that same day. But short of that, at the very least, if you have access to a farmer's market, you know, going to the market, picking up the broccoli and then eating it that day or maybe the next day as one of the first vegetables you eat, because you know, after reading your book, that it's one that loses its nutrient value as quickly or more quickly than most others.
That's right. And if, so let's say you do buy them in the supermarket, which most people do, buy these rapidly respiring fruits and vegetables, you need to eat them first. You eat them the night that you buy them or the next day, and you let the apples and potatoes and carrots, you know, let those last longer because they're not burning up their antioxidants so rapidly.
Right. Yeah, this is so important because I think a lot of people without this knowledge, they buy the broccoli, they put it in a drawer in the refrigerator, and they might eat it, you know, a week later perhaps, and think that they're getting the same benefit that they would if they would have eaten it right away.
Yeah, so, the kale, you know, it's pushed to the back,
right?
And you don't see it until it's way too late.
yeah. So speaking of this storage, you mentioned a few different interesting points about how to properly store certain fruits and vegetables to maximize their nutrient value. Maybe you could give us a few examples of that.
These rapid respirers, these most nutritious of all fruits and vegetables, we need to do everything we can to stop that oxidation process. And that means keeping things away from light and oxygen and heat primarily. So I'll give you an example about spinach. Spinach loses its antioxidants within a week, okay? So when you get it and bring it home, you want to put it in a plastic bag, take a sealable bag, and press most of the air out of it, seal it, but then prick it with little holes, like I just take a needle or a pin, 10 holes per side. This came from a study. I'm not inventing this.
Not making it up, yeah.
I'm not making it up.
Yeah.
And what you've done is you've limited the amount of oxygen that spinach has access to, so it can't use up its antioxidants as rapidly.
Right.
And it's also going to keep its sugars longer.
Mm-hmm.
So this one easy trick can, well, what did I see? Okay, so this particular study found that if you do this, if you put it in a bag and you prick with little tiny holes, that you have 125% more antioxidants after just one day.
I mean, wow.
You would have lost that.
Yeah.
So it's important to do that if you're striving for optimum health, which many of us are. Like you're fighting disease.
Exactly. How about lettuce? And, you know, it's a lot of people, as you point out in the book, the only one of the few vegetables they eat is iceberg lettuce. But even, you know, even people who are health conscious, they tend to eat a lot of salads and lettuce. So what's the best way to store lettuce and green leafy greens when you get them home?
The first step in the process is choosing the right varieties.
Mm-hmm.
It's no surprise that iceberg lettuce is really low in nutrients. So when you're in the store, there's this hierarchy of nutrition in lettuce. After the iceberg comes light green leafy lettuce and then dark green leafy lettuce. You know, each of those is more nutritious than the next. And then green leafy lettuce with brown and orange tinges. And then finally, the most nutritious lettuce is red leaf lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you veer towards that dark green and especially the red colors. And then, you know, you bring them home and you treat them. One of the things that you can do, and here's another bizarre study. I love these.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
This particular one found that if you take your lettuce and you rip it up the day before you eat it, so you brought it home from the store and you rinsed it and you dried it, rip it into bite-sized pieces, put it in that plastic bag, squeeze the air out, do the pinpricks, and in one day, because you have ripped it up, it will have four times more antioxidants. And why?
Mm-hmm.
The question is why. It's because, as I said before, that lettuce is still living. It's not dead. And it thinks that it's being eaten by this big animal when we rip that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so overnight, it's going to create these compounds, these phytonutrients, to protect itself for the next animal that comes along. And we've ripped it up, and we've just given it the message to make more phytonutrients.
Mm-hmm. It's a form of...
And then we get to eat them.
Right. It's like a form of hormesis or adaptive positive stress. Some of the studies that I've read about the beneficial effects of antioxidants in humans is that they're actually mild prooxidants, but they invoke our own antioxidant defense system.
Yes.
And that's the way that they...
System.
Yeah. So that's really fascinating. Garlic. I found that really... Oh, lettuce. Just one thought. The other thing that you mentioned that I wasn't aware of about lettuce was that the varieties that are less densely packed together, where there's, you know, some the looser leaf are more nutritious. Is that right?
Right.
Did I get that right?
Yes, and it's that same principle, because compared with the head lettuce, which is all wrapped up tight, loose leaf lettuce has all of its leaves arrayed to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the sun has UVA, UVB rays, which will destroy that lettuce unless it produces this, you know, botanical sunscreen, all these phytonutrients.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the loose leaf lettuce is better for us than the head lettuce, is because it was stressed, as we were talking, you know, by sunlight.
Right.
So we get all those benefits.
That makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about garlic. You mentioned in the book that, of course, a lot of people are aware of garlic's antimicrobial properties, but they may not be aware just how powerful those can be and how to maximize those by preparing it properly.
Right. Garlic, something that has impressed me going to health conferences and reading studies, is that garlic is one of the most potent cancer fighters known.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't known until, I think it was a 2006 study, that if we take garlic, fresh garlic, and if we put it into hot oil or hot foods right away, we destroy its ability to produce allicin, which is the cancer-fighting compound that's so important in garlic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This study found that if you simply chop it, press it, dice it, and set it aside for 10 minutes. During that time that it's resting, it makes copious amounts of this allicin. Mm-hmm. And once it's created, it is not destroyed by heat.
Uh-huh.
So the simple step, anytime we're cooking with garlic, is to press and rest. We will have those benefits we thought we were getting all along.
Mm-hmm. So no need to eat.
That's an example of a nugget that I pulled out that people should have known about.
Oh, yeah. And it's not that big of a deal. You know, it's not that difficult to add that to your routine. And I'm sure a lot of people have been chowing raw garlic because they thought that was the only way to get the benefits. And particularly their partners might be grateful to have this information. So I'm just curious, have there been any studies done, you know, comparing the allicin contents with I'm sure you could do that just by looking at data that compare, you know, supplements with certain kind of allicin content and then raw garlic with that's prepared in this kind of way. Are we talking about similar concentrations? Because, of course, it's my belief that, you know, we're adapted to get nutrients from whole foods and that's the best way to get them. But I wonder, you know, if that's consistent in this case with garlic as a therapeutic agent.
Yeah, garlic we're talking about. We're talking about aged garlic, which is prepared specifically for health reasons. We're talking about garlic salts and flakes.
Mm-hmm.
This bottled garlic that you can get peeled and all of those things. And some of, you know, the aged garlic, which is prepared for health reasons, is actually very effective.
Mm-hmm.
But there's none of the commercial preparations that are any good for us except for freeze-dried garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And freeze-drying preserves those nutrients that we, you know, that are in garlic, so that's great. But the fresh garlic prepared correctly is just an excellent protective food. And we need to be eating a lot of it.
And cheap and readily available and relatively easy to prepare, as you've pointed out in that way.
Yeah.
And now, of course, used in a lot of different types of cuisine, too.
Yeah. And here's something you might be interested in, because you know a lot about this subject. It's just been discovered why garlic is such an incredibly potent antioxidant. And I was thrilled to find out. That's because it will attack free radicals, which are these noxious particles that your listeners probably know about, more rapidly than any other substance known.
Wow.
So these free radicals are going to attack the nearest molecule to them in a nanosecond. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
But garlic is faster. Garlic is going to destroy those free radicals before they can get to an important part of our body, like our DNA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about not only the kind of indirect effect of activating the, you know, these antioxidant defense system, but also a direct effect of quenching oxidative damage, which of course is a major mechanism in almost all modern chronic inflammatory disease.
Which our ancestors, as you know, who were hunter-gatherers, did not have.
That's right. They had other problems, but they didn't have those problems.
That's right. And here's what I find so interesting. The problems that they did have, except for warfare, we've solved most of them.
That's right. That's right.
We've solved the problems that killed hunter-gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
So what is evident to people who are interested in paleo food, and especially with this added component of these missing phytonutrients, that if we take advantage of all of our modern medicine that we have in our diagnostic tests and our emergency medicine and add back these phytonutrients, which are so protective against the disease that are killing us now, we will be the healthiest people who ever walked on this planet, instead
That's
of
right.
people who are living a very long time and not doing a very good job of it.
That's right. That's, I mean, why not get the best of both worlds here? And it's such a lost opportunity, because as you pointed out, we have the knowledge now to do it. And it's, I'm sure you experienced this yourself, but oftentimes when I'm reading the literature, I have these moments where I'm like, this is amazing. This is game changing. This is like a whole, new paradigm. And why isn't everybody out talking about this? You know, there's this really frustrating lag time between, what the researchers are talking about in the literature and then what becomes, you know, the conventional paradigm mainstream knowledge. So, you know, kudos to you for taking a huge step and making this information available, because I've been studying these topics for a long time myself as well. And I learned a lot reading your book and a lot of information that, you know, we've already put into practice. Like, for example, now we go to the farmer's market every Saturday, and now we have broccoli on Saturday night pretty reliably because we know that, I mean, it's that's the way to get the most of the nutrients. So speaking of that, let's there's so many good examples of in your book, of course. And so I really recommend to everyone listening to go out and get the book. It's a real goldmine of information and really practical stuff that you can start using right away. But for some of our listeners, Joe, maybe you could just talk about some of the most nutrient-dense vegetables and fruits that you can buy in the average supermarket and farmer's market today that still have whose nutrients haven't been cultivated out of them, so to speak.
Yes, and this is a new idea to people as well, which is there's a vast range of these important nutrients among the varieties of fruits and vegetables in the store. For example, we all know that onions are great for us. We've known that for a long time. But if you get a sweet onion, you're going to have about 20% the antioxidants as you would get, and also the cancer-fighting compounds as you would get from choosing a one that has more fire to it.
Mm-hmm.
So if once we know this, we can say, okay, I'm going to choose a sweet onion if I'm going to put a big slab on a sandwich. But if I'm ever cooking with onions, I'm only going to get these hot ones because they're so much better for me. And I was surprised to learn that the most nutritious onion in the store, they're green onions.
Right.
You know, scallions that we don't even think about as a highly nutritious food.
Yeah,
of them have. It has 120 times more antioxidants than a white onion. Go ahead.
That's amazing, and I was just going to say that green onions are actually considered to be a medicinal in Chinese medicine. So it's fascinating that they knew that, you know, thousands of years ago without having access to any of these modern methods that we're using now.
Yes, I didn't know that. That's so interesting. But they did have powers of observation.
Absolutely. which is a scientific method.
A doctor, yeah, and you know, we're prescribed something, and nobody's observing anything. You know.
Right. Exactly.
Right, and it's the green part of the green onion that's best for us.
Mm-hmm.
So chop it all the way up.
So one that surprised me a lot was artichokes and artichoke hearts, because mm-hmm. here you have a kind of a white vegetable, which typically, you know, maybe with the exception of cauliflower, you know, we think of white as being not very nutritious as a flavor, as an appearance. But you mentioned that artichokes and particularly artichoke hearts are one of the most nutrient dense vegetables we can eat.
That's because, this is something else that I've just recently learned. There's many, many families of these polyphenols, these phytonutrients, I call them.
Mm-hmm.
But only two of them have pigments. Only two families can be seen visually. So what these artichoke hearts have and other pale-looking vegetables and fruits, they have very potent phytonutrients that have no pigment to them. And we don't know. We can't look at them and know that they're good for us. We need to go buy a list. We need to, you know, have someone tell us these are great for you, even though they're not, you know, purple and red and green and all of these colors. We've been, you know, it's what we've been told to look for. And those colors are important. But there's many foods which are white and good for us.
Mm-hmm. And then tomatoes. So small varieties of tomatoes, more nutritious than larger varieties, right?
Amazingly so. Lycopene is the most important phytonutrient in tomatoes. And a small cherry tomato might have 20 times more lycopene than a big slicing beefsteak tomato, which is a total human creation. You will not find that in nature.
Mm-hmm.
In nature, tomatoes look just like cherry tomatoes or even
smaller. Right.
And so the ones cherry tomatoes are actually as good as wild tomatoes in terms of their health benefits. And they're sitting right there in the grocery store, and we didn't know it.
Yeah, easy to find. And I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners here are well aware of the taste difference between a cherry tomato or any tomato from the farmer's market or the backyard, for example, and the grocery store. So it's great to know that there's even further reasons to choose those varieties.
Yes, and it that brings up an important point. Many phytonutrients that are best for us are bitter, but it's not always the case. Sometimes the sweet foods are better for us, and that's the case for these cherry tomatoes, which are higher in sugar and have much more flavor density than the large ones, and they're better for us. So that's a great situation.
Yeah,
we don't
have
to
have
bitter foods always to be healthier.
So what about fruits? How can, what are the most nutritious fruits from this perspective? Which are the ones that have maintained most of, the more of their nutrient density than others?
Well, the ones we eat the most of have the least nutrient density.
Yeah, that's typical.
It is typical. So, for example, Thompson's seedless grapes. It's a 1,000-year-old heirloom. We can't assume that heirloom plants are better for us. This was a mutant that someone discovered and fell in love with 1,000 years ago somewhere in Persia because it didn't have any seeds.
Yeah.
But what they didn't know, and what they only know within the last 15 years, is that the Thompson seedless grape has lost the ability to produce anthocyanins and resveratrol, which are the two reasons to eat grapes and to drink red wine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our favorite grape. So what you want to do is you want to get the darker colored grapes. The darker, almost black ones are great for us. Concord grapes are wonderful. They're almost a wild grape.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically a cross between many wild grapes, different kinds of wild grapes. And the dark red ones, and they now are seedless. We found a way to make them seedless, so we don't have to, lose the nutrients just to get a seedless grape. I'm growing this wonderful black seedless grape that I can hardly wait for it to ripen.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I really love about your book is that you provide this great information about varieties of all of these foods that are not typical anymore, but that if you're a gardener and you're inclined, you can often order these seeds, I would imagine, from catalogs or something like that and grow them yourself.
Gardeners are in the best possible position to have the most nutritious, best tasting food. And I'm really a proponent of gardening, and I'm delighted to see that it's spreading like a plague across this country. People are tearing up their parking strips and planting fruits and vegetables. This is such a healthy trend.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, like in at the end of each chapter of my book, I list exactly which varieties to look for in the farmer's market, but also in seed catalogs. So you can just go down that list and order them. If you can't find them in the seed catalogs that you're used to using, you can simply Google the name, and you will find it. You will find those seeds, and you can harvest them when they're fully ripened and eat them as soon as you harvest them. That's the way to go. I have a wonderful garden, and every year it gets a little better as my research progresses. I really want us to be moving in that direction.
It's almost like the concept of a victory garden, but for health, like a victory over all of these chronic inflammatory diseases that are literally killing us and debilitating us every year. And something as relatively simple as just choosing some of these wild varieties to grow in your backyard, which of course has other benefits like getting you off your butt and moving around and exposed to sunlight and getting your hands in the dirt and, feeling your feet on the ground and all of these other important things that we talk about that are, crucial contributors to health. I think and saving money too, of course. There's also that. So it makes sense on so many different levels, and I just think that your book is such a great resource. It's so important, and I'm just really excited to be able to help get the word out about this, because it's definitely changed the way that we You know, I consider myself a foodie. I consider myself pretty well educated about food, of course. I write about it, talk about it a lot, and I definitely learned a lot reading your book, and looking forward to putting even more of it in practice. So thanks again for joining us, Joe. And the name of the book is Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. It's, of course, available in all the usual locations. So go out and pick up a copy and get to work.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking with you.